appreciate the opportunity to address this question and to be here. I appreciate Chad coming and participating in this, and I told him just a moment ago, I appreciate the fact that he appealed to Scripture. We haven't been hearing much of that, and I hope everyone pays attention to the fact that he was trying to appeal to Scripture. While I'll disagree with a lot of what he had to say, I appreciate the fact that he was trying with reference to Scripture, because that's the basis on which we can have unity if we ever have unity at all. I had not met Chad before last night. I met he and his dad, and I barged in on their breakfast this morning and sat down and visited with them a little while and enjoyed the visit, but it's good to get to know him. I told the brethren where I preach Sunday night when I left, where I was going and what was taking place, because I'd preached on some things along this line in preparation for this, and several said, come back and report how things went. And I am going to be delighted to report that according to the owner of the Gospel Advocate, that those of the institutional brethren here are among the cream of the crop. The brethren at home will be surprised I made the cut. And when I tell them who the other non-institutional brethren were, they'll be even more surprised you made the cut. And even more surprising than that, according to Brother Warpula, I am an institutionalist because I make a distinction between the individual and collective action. So I'll go back and report I'm an institutional brother that is one who is among the cream of the crop of the non-institutionals. That'll be confusing. One issue between non-institutional and institutional brethren is the question of, can the church, out of its treasury, help those who are non-Christians? In the 1950s and 1960s, when the issues were developing and being debated in those times, this was not the dividing issue. There were men like W. Curtis Porter who debated this a number of times. He debated Guy Woods twice in 56 and in 57. Roy Deaver in 1957, and at the time of his death, 1960, he had proposition signed with W.L. Toddy. But Brother Porter refused to debate this question because he felt it was not the issue that was dividing brethren. And he felt the time could be better spent focusing on the real issue that divided brethren. It wasn't that he didn't have a position on this. And it wasn't that he thought the church could take out of its treasury and help those that were non-Christians. It was the fact that this was not the dividing issue. But in time, as you know, history developed, there were other men like A.C. Grider, who I knew personally and worked with and was in the same congregation with him for a while, felt that it was a real issue and that it should be debated, and he did, and brought it to the forefront. In any discussion of any issue, we need to talk about what the issue really is. And so as we talk about the scope of benevolence, I want to begin with the issue. We need to clarify what the issue is and what the issue is not, lest we spend time talking about something that is not related to the issue. And so I want to suggest to you that when we talk about the issue here is not, should the care be given to those who are needy? We all agree with that. And there have been several things said this week about caring for those who are in need, and I agree with that, and every person here agrees that we ought to care for the needy. And secondly, the issue is not, is the church obligated to some? It certainly is. The church does have obligation and benevolence. We all agree with that. And the issue is not, can individuals care for non-saints? Because they can and they should. Nor is the issue, will care be provided for orphan children? Care will be provided for orphan children and has been. And furthermore, the issue is not, do non-saints deserve help? They do deserve help. And they should be helped. And that is not the issue at all. And neither is the question, what are the non-institutional brethren doing with reference to benevolence? I'm not saying this charge has been made, but if the charge were to be made, as it has been in years past, that we're doing nothing with reference to caring for the needy, first, that is not true. And secondly, it doesn't touch on the issue at all. The issue is, can the church out of its treasury help those who are non-saints, or can it help only saints? Can the church as a collectivity help only those who are saints, or can it take out of its treasury and help those who are non-saints? I want to spend some time talking about who the church can help. And I want to look at 9 New Testament passages now that we're going to consider one by one. And each one of these are passages that will say that either believers, believer, disciples, brethren, saints, or widow indeed, or something equivalent thereto, that those are the ones the church out of its treasury can help. And so we'll quickly take a look at those, and we're not going to spend a great deal of time. But here is who the church can help. In Acts chapter 2, verses 44 and 45, those who believed were together and had all things common and sold their possessions and goods and divided among all as everyone had need. And so we conclude from Acts chapter 2 that it was those who believed that were helped. Well, let's go to Acts chapter 4 now. In Acts chapter 4, 32 to 35, we see that it was believers. The text says, "Now the multitude of those who believed were of one heart and one soul. Neither was any among them that would say of the things that he possessed was his own, but they all had things in common." Dropping down to verse 34. "Nor was there any among them," that is those who believed, "who lacked, for all who were possessors of lands and houses sold them and brought the proceeds of the things that were sold and laid them at the apostles' feet and were distributed to each one as he had need." Well, let's go further to Acts chapter 6, verses 1 through 6. We saw in Acts 4, it was those who believed. Well, in Acts chapter 6, verses 1 through 6, it was disciples that were relieved. And you remember, we won't read all of verses 1 through 7, that in those days when the number of disciples were multiplying, there arose a complaint among the Hebrews by the Hellenists because their widows, that is among the disciples, were neglected in the daily distribution. And so the 12 summoned the multitude of the disciples and said, "It is not desirable that we should leave the word of God and serve tables." And you know the rest of the story. It was disciples that were helped. Well, let's go to Acts chapter 11 now. Here's another case. The fourth case that we list is the case in Acts chapter 11. In Acts chapter 11, 27 through 30, in those days the prophets came from Jerusalem to Antioch, and one of them named Agabus stood up and showed by the Spirit that there was going to be a great famine throughout all the world, which also happened in the days of Claudius Caesar. Then the disciples, each one according to his ability, determined to send relief to the brethren dwelling in Judea. This they also did and sent it to the elders by the hand of Barnabas and Saul. Here we have church action, and it is to those who were brethren. So who is it that was relieved? It was those who were brethren in Acts chapter 11. Chad has already mentioned that Romans 15, 1 Corinthians 16, 2 Corinthians 8 and 9 tie together, talking about the same event. We'll say more about that in a moment. And that is for the needy saints in Jerusalem. Romans 15 says, beginning at verse 25, "I'm going to Jerusalem to minister to the saints. And it pleased those of Macedonia and Achaia to make a certain contribution for the poor saints among those who are at Jerusalem," the text says. Well, let's go a little bit further. Drop down to verse 31. "That I may be delivered from those in Judea who do not believe, that my service for Jerusalem may be acceptable to the saints." So who is it that was helped out of the church treasury? It was those who were indeed saints. Well, let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 16, verses 1 and 2. In 1 Corinthians 16, 1 and 2, again, it was saints. It's the same circumstance that we read about in Romans 15. "Now concerning the collection for the saints, as I have given order to the churches of Galatia, so you must also do." Well, let's go to another text talking about the same event, this time in 2 Corinthians chapter 8. In 2 Corinthians chapter 8, the whole chapter, for that matter, deals with this, but verses 1 to 4, that he says, "Moreover, brethren," he said, I want to drop down to verse 4 in interest of time, that I might save time for some other things in a moment. He said, "imploring us with much urgency that we would receive the gift and the fellowship of the ministering to the saints." And so again, here it was saints that were helped out of the church treasury. Well, we've already been treated to 2 Corinthians chapter 9, and we'll say more about 2 Corinthians 9:13 a little bit later. But 2 Corinthians chapter 9, still talking about the same event of Romans 15, 1 Corinthians 16, 2 Corinthians 8, and now chapter 9, the same event. Now, concerning verse 1 says, the ministering to the saints. Verse 12 says that ministration of the service not only supplieth the needs of the saints, but is also abounding through many thanksgiving to God. So at verse 1, verse 12, it was for those who were saints. Well, let's add one more passage to that. And here's the ninth of the 9 passages, 1 Timothy 5 and in verse 16. In 1 Timothy 5 and verse 16, it was a widow indeed. If any man believing, or if any believing man or woman has widows, let them relieve them, and do not let the church be burdened, that it may relieve those who are really widows. The King James uses the term widows indeed. Verse 5, and if you're following in your manuscript, I've got verse 16, it should be verse 5, this widow trusts in God. The widow indeed is one who puts her trust in God, which means then that she indeed is one who is a saint or a child of God. Now here's what we've seen. We've had these nine New Testament passages, and here are four of which are talking about the same case and the same event. But all of these nine New Testament passages deal with ministering to believers or disciples or brethren or saints, or a widow indeed, which is one who trusts in God. Now, I might draw a parallel with that in some other matters. We raise the question of who can relieve, and we list on the side of those who are saints. We're talking about collective action out of the church treasury. That is our question. Not whether an individual could do that, but can the church out of its treasury do that? And we have nine New Testament passages, but on the side of the non-saints, there is not a passage, and I'm going to show that. I'm going to deal with all three of the passages. Chad dealt with just a few moments ago. But I want you to notice, there's not a one of these passages that say saints only. Now, Chad didn't ask this while ago, nor has anyone else that I know of, or at least I didn't catch it. But I've been asked before in discussions like this, that where do these passages say saints only? Well, they don't say saints only, but they only say saints. That's all they say. Or some equivalent, like brethren or believers. You understand what I'm saying. Well, let me draw you a parallel to that, and that is when we have discussions on instrumental music. We have 10 New Testament passages that say sing, sang, sung, or fruit of our lips, or something equivalent to that. There's not a one of these passages that say sing only, but they only say sing. It doesn't say sing only, but it only says sing. And so that is the only thing that is authorized in our worship. There isn't a passage, though they argue some, and they cite passages. There are passages that sometimes are cited that they think incorporate instrumental music. But there's not a New Testament passage that tells us to do that. But they only say sing. And so thus we have a parallel that's quite interesting. Now I want to spend a little bit of time, as Brother Payne did this morning, doing this same kind of thing of drawing a distinction between the individual and the church. Because if this principle is not true, then answering this question of the scope of church benevolence is irrelevant. We don't even need to talk about that. Because if the individual and the church are not distinct, and whatever the individual can do, the church can do, then we don't even need to raise a question about church benevolence, do we? We just need to see, should needy be cared for, and if they should be cared for, then the church or an individual or anybody could do that. So is there a distinction in the individual and the church? Well, let's talk about some misconceptions about the church and the individual. One misconception that people have is that the individual is a church. And that is that whatever the individual is doing, the church is doing. Another misconception that some have, and they contend, and that is that what the individual can do, the church can do. We were treated to that a little bit ago in the interim there a little bit. We may talk about that, Brother Wapner. And that is, some come from the angle of saying that whatever every individual can do, the church can do. Others would argue from the standpoint that there is no distinction in the instructions in the New Testament to an individual and a church. And a third misconception we want to address, and that is that when individuals act, the church is acting. And so whatever you're doing, that is the church doing that. Those are all closely related. But I want to move now and talk about the fact that the individual and the church are not the same. They are not the same. They are distinct. I want us to see that the body has many members. And so let's open our Bibles and let's turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 12. I want us to look at verse 12, verse 14, verse 27. And I want to establish that the body has many members. An individual is not one member. An individual is not a church, is what our conclusion will be. Look at verse 12. Verse 12 says, "For as the body is one and has many members, and all the members of that one body being many are one body, so also is Christ." And so what I'm seeing is a distinction between an individual and a group, that is a church, as a collectivity. Well, let's go to verse 14, same verse. I'm seeing a distinction between a member and many members. For in fact, the body is not one member, but many. There's a difference in the body and the member. There's a distinction in the individual and the church. Let's go again to verse 27. Verse 27 says that you are the body of Christ and members individually. And so what we're establishing is the fact the body has many members. There's a difference in the individual and the church. But let's also illustrate that with Diotrephes. He was mentioned this morning. I believe Brother Payne mentioned him. And correctly so, that there is a distinction. Notice that the text says in 3 John and verse 9, I wrote to the church, but Diotrephes, who loves to have the preeminence among them, does not receive us. Diotrephes wasn't the church, but he was among the church there. And so there's a distinction between Diotrephes and the church. It was addressed and dealt with in 2nd or 3rd John and in verse 9. But let's go further. I see the body has many members, but the second thing I want us to notice concerning the individual and the church not being the same is the role of the individual and the church are not the same. Their role is different. How so? Well, let's look at 1 Timothy 5 and verse 16. Their role is different. That is, here is a responsibility of an individual that is not the responsibility of the church. And let's see what that is. If any believing man or woman has widows, let them relieve them and do not let the church be burdened. In other words, here is a responsibility for this individual that is not the responsibility of the church. And so if I say the individual and the church are the same, or whatever the individuals do, the church can do, then what I'm saying is the church can do the very thing that Paul said, do not let the church be burdened. There is a distinction in their role. Well, let's go even further. I want us to notice there is a difference. Okay, carefully follow this point. There is a difference in individual action, individuals acting together, and collective action. Now, we were talking a little about that in the last session or two. Let's see if we can find some example of that. Well, here we have in Matthew chapter 18. Matthew 18, beginning at verse 15 through verse 17. Moreover, if your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault between you and him alone, and if he hears you, you have gained your brother. But if he will not hear, take with you one or two more at the mouth of two or three witnesses, every word may be established. Now, verse 17. And if he refuses to hear them, tell it to the church. Well, if the individual and the church are one and the same, then when you told it to this individual, you'd already told it to the church. There's a difference in the individual and the church, but let's go a step further with that same passage. I want you to see that in verse 15, verse 16, verse 17, you have three distinct things. You have it, verse 15, moreover, if your brother sins against you, you go tell him his fault between you and him alone. Here's an individual acting. Then you take with you one or two more. This isn't the church acting. If so, then what are you doing over here at verse 17 that's different than in verse 16? It's got to be different, isn't it? Don't you have a difference between these individuals acting, but they're not acting as a collectivity, but then you tell it to the church, so we have an individual, we have individuals that are not acting as a collectivity, and then you have the collectivity over here at verse 17. And so there's a difference in individuals acting and the church acting as a collectivity. But let's go even further. Thirdly, I want to talk about areas wherein they differ. And I just want to be brief with reference to this regard. There is more material and Brother Payne's material on this than is in mine on a number of distinctions. And that is, first of all, they differ in their work and their responsibility. How so? Well, let's look at 1 Timothy 5:16 again. We've already been treated to this. But there's the work and responsibility of this man or woman that believing having widows, and that's different from the responsibility of the church because they are to relieve them and the church is not to be burdened. So they are distinct in their work and their role. Now let's go even further with reference to that distinction. They differ not only in their work and responsibility and how their money is obtained. We've already noted in our studies today that the individual could get their money by buying and selling, James 4:13, working that they may have money to give to those who have in need, Ephesians 4:28. And that's certainly a way we could gain money. I could go in business. I could go in the real estate business, the car business. Whatever business I want to go in, I could buy and I could sell and I could get gain. Nothing wrong with that. But then we come over here to the church, and the church can get its money by free will offering. We do not recognize that the church can buy and sell and get gain. Could the church go into the real estate business? Could they go into the car business? Could they go into any other kind of business and buy and sell and get gain? They differ in their work as well as in their responsibility and how they get money. Here's another thing. They differ in their name. I recognize the Bible doesn't teach that there is one designation to the exclusion of all others that are found in scriptures with reference to the church. But the individual wears the name Christian. 1 Peter 4:16, if any man suffer as a Christian, let him not be ashamed but glorify God on this behalf. And so a plurality of them in Acts 11 and verse 26 were called Christians. The disciples were called Christians. One of them would be a Christian, wouldn't he? And so the individual wears the name Christian, but the church as a collectivity would wear the name Church of God or Church of Christ or Church of the Firstborn or any other designation you find. My point is that we don't take the term Christian and apply it to the church, or do we? Is the church a Christian? Do you wear that name? I would refer you to pay attention to the Porter Hunt debate on that Christian name back in 1956. But let's go even further. I want you to see that there is a difference in individual and collective action. What we've tried to establish is some of the misconceptions concerning the individual and the church. The individual and the church are not the same. Areas wherein they differ. Let's talk about the difference in individual and collective action. I guess that makes me institutional, doesn't it, Brother Walker? Church collective action is not the action of the individual. Even a plurality of individuals is not collective action. Collective action is when the church functions as a unit. Now, we all understand that. We understand how that works when it comes to a chain. You might go to the hardware store and you buy a single link. I doubt you'd come back with that single link and say, look at my chain. You don't have a chain yet, do you? You go back to the hardware store and you buy several links, individually, that are separated one from the other. They're not tied together as a unit. You still don't say, look at my chain. You have a link, you have links, but when you put them together as a unit, now we have a chain. We all understand that when it comes to chains and links and a link. We understand that. Well, let's talk about how that would apply to the church. When it comes to the church, we have an individual, for example, like the link. Body is not one member, but many, Paul said, 1 Corinthians 12:14. We don't have a chain. We don't have a collectivity yet. We don't have a church yet. We might have a plurality of individuals doing something, like Matthew 18. Take with you one or two more at the mouth of two or three witnesses, every word may be established. I know we don't have the church because I haven't yet told it to the church, verse 17. So we have individuals acting. And so when you have a group of individuals acting, doing something, you don't have the church acting. And so if 10 of us individuals get together and we form a college, that's not the church doing that. 10 of us get together and give Brother Payne a contribution for the college. That's not the church acting. It's individuals doing that. But then when you form together as a unit, now we have the church acting. Like in Acts chapter 11, they sent it to the brethren which dwelt in Judea. That was a collection that was put together in one fund and sent it to the elders. Now we have the church functioning as a unit. So if I can understand the link and the links in the chain, I can understand the individuals and the church functioning as a unit. Our question isn't, can these brethren here, or can this individual help non-saints? Can these individuals help non-saints? We're talking about, can the church out of a treasury as a collectivity help those who are non-saints? How am I doing on my time? Left or taken? All right, I want you to notice there is a distinction in collective action and distributive action. Church may act in a collective sense or in a distributive sense. What do we mean by that? Well, a church may act in a collective sense. What does the word collective mean? Well, it has denoting the number of persons or things considered as one group or whole. Term flock would be a collective term. And so when we talk about the church, what it did, that it may relieve those who are widows indeed, that's collective action, functioning as a whole. But a church may act in a distributive sense, referring singly without exception to the members of a group, not as a whole, such as the word each and either, none, or distributive. I'll give you an example of that. Let's look at 1 Timothy 5:16. In a collective sense, that it may relieve those who are widows indeed. This is the church acting as a unit. But the church could act in a distributive sense, and in that sense, it may be referred to as the church, but they're functioning individually. How so? Well, let's look at Acts chapter 8, if you will. That Saul made havoc of the church, Acts 8, verses 3 and 4. Entering into every house, dragging off men and women, committing them, that is the church, to prison. Therefore, those, King James says, they who were scattered went everywhere preaching the word. Now, they're not functioning as a unit now. Here the church was scattered and they went everywhere preaching the word, but it was attributed to the church in a distributive sense. And so there is a sense in which several individuals from a church may do something, and we may say, well, the church at El Bethel did that, but they didn't do that out of the church treasury. several of those acting as they did in Acts chapter 8. Perhaps more about that in our question and answer period. Here's a summary of what we've just seen. The distinction in the individual and the church. The individual is a member. The church is many members. The individual cares for its own. The church is not to be burdened. The individual matter should be kept private, Matthew 18, but individual matters now become a matter of the church. They differ in how they gain their money, the name that they wear, and we saw that Diotrephes was not the church. There is a clear distinction between the individual and the church. So how does that relate to the question of the scope of benevolence? That I must find a passage that talks about the church as a collectivity, and out of its treasury can take money and help those who are non-saints to address the issue. If I find a passage that talks about the individual, that didn't touch the issue, did it? And that's the importance of noticing the distinction in the individual and the church. Now, here are three conclusions. Since the individual and the church are not the same, the responsibility of the individual is not the responsibility of the church. I have to conclude that. I have to conclude that what the individual does is not the actions of the church. And I have to conclude that passages that address individual responsibility do not address the church. We'll say more about that here in just a few moments. I want us to move now and talk about the passages that are used to justify benevolence to non-saints. And these are the three passages that Chad treated us to just a few moments ago. Let's start with this one in James 1:27. And again, I want to commend him. I appreciate him appealing to scriptures. We haven't been treated to much of that, and I appreciate him doing that. But let's look at James chapter 1 and in verse 27. Pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father is this, to visit the fatherless and or the orphans and the widows in their trouble and to keep oneself unspotted from the world. And no one questions the fact that this passage says that orphans and widows should be helped, but the question is this a matter of individual responsibility or is this the church as a collectivity here? I want to say more about what Chad had to say a few moments ago toward the end of our study here in just a moment. But I want to suggest to you that if you look at the context, that the context has these personal pronouns that tell me that this is individual responsibility. I'm not going to go through each one of those. You can read those for yourself. They're in the manuscript. Where the text talks about us and we and every man and your souls and yourselves and anyone, he, man, his, himself. And then when I come to verse 27, that pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father is this, to keep oneself or himself unspotted from the world. But I'm more interested in this here. That I want you to see that the one who is to visit the orphans and the widows in their trouble is the same one that is to keep oneself unspotted from the world. If not, why not? The same one that is told to visit is the same one that is to keep. Now, my question is, does that refer to an individual, or does it refer to the church? Now, if I say that to visit the orphans and the widows applies to the church, then the keeping oneself unspotted from the world applies to the church as a collectivity. Am I to keep myself individually unspotted from the world, or does the church as a collectivity do that for me? Which one? Those kinds of questions need to be addressed, and I want to suggest to you that the one word himself or oneself, King James uses the word himself, is an individual. Notice again, the same one that is to visit is the same one that is to keep what? Keep himself or oneself. Does oneself or himself describe the church or the individual? Which one does it describe? Those of you who have attended debates with reference to the denominationalists and who've argued the general church question that used to be argued years ago. It hadn't been argued much in years. That in the general church question, they would sometimes come back to John 15 and argue that in John 15, this is an argument for denominationalism. In John 15, that I am the vine and ye are the branches. The branches refer to denominations, was the argument that they were making. And brethren pointed out in those discussions that in John 15, these personal pronouns show that the branches, you and you and you and anyone and he, does not refer to churches, but refers to individuals. It's the individuals that are the branches, not the churches. And if I can find the church in James chapter 1 with these personal pronouns, I can find churches over here in John 15. Just like that. It's the same kind of point that was made, as was made in the general church question a number of years ago. Let's go to the second passage that we want to address, and that's in Galatians chapter 6 and in verse 10. Galatians 6 and verse 10, again, the question is not, does this passage include non-saints? I won't argue that point. It does include non-saints. But the question is this individual action, when it says, therefore, as we therefore have opportunity, let us do good unto all men, especially those of the household of faith. I want you to look at the context with me, if you will. You who are spiritual, verse 1. And by the way, I'm not sure, I didn't catch the scholar Chad cited a moment ago that went through and mentioned this is corporate and this is individual and this is corporate and individual, but that was arbitrary. Whoever that was arbitrary distinction. A purely arbitrary distinction he made. I'm not saying Chad made that, but his scholar he cited did. But look at verse 1. You who are spiritual, consider yourself, lest you also be tempted. The church or the individual? Verse 3, anyone himself. Drop down to verse 7. Moreover, as a man sows, that will he also reap. Do we sow and reap as individuals or as a collectivity? Are we going to reap as a collectivity? Are we going to reap as an individual? What do the judgment scene passages talk about? Do they not suggest that we're going to reap individually? Or does it suggest it's going to be as a collectivity? And yes, verse 12, Chad paid attention to this, they compelled you to be circumcised. That's just two verses later. Do you circumcise individuals or churches? Well, he said individuals. And that's what I say. We'll say more about Galatians 6 perhaps in a moment. But I want us to go further with reference to Galatians chapter 6. Paul said, let us do good unto all. Uses the first person plural. The speaker is included in the noun class. Was Paul an individual or was he a church? It's a good question that we need to address. Now let's go to 2 Corinthians 9 and verse 13. 2 Corinthians 9 and in verse 13. And so I will admit that James 1, 27 would include non-saints. Galatians 6, 10 includes non-saints, but it's not church action. But 2 Corinthians 9 is church action, I will admit, but I'm not admitting that it's reference to non-saints. And we'll see why as we go along. Here's the question with reference to 2 Corinthians 9:13: for your liberal sharing with them and all men. The question is the them referring to saints and the all men non-saints? That's the question at hand. And Chad recognized that a moment ago when he mentioned that. Well, let's look at some things in the context of 2 Corinthians chapter 9. Let's go back to when contributions were raised. You remember I mentioned earlier 2 Corinthians 8, 2 Corinthians 9, 1 Corinthians 16, Romans 15 are talking about the same event. We all recognize that. And when the money was raised, it was for poor saints, Romans 15, 25, and 1 Corinthians 16, 1. That's who it was raised for, is for saints. Well, let's go even further. In the context, notice at verse 1. In the context at verse 1, the text says, now concerning the ministering to the saints. This was the context of benevolence for saints. It was raised for saints. Paul said, I'm talking about that which was for saints. But I want you to notice those who were relieved. I want you to notice this in 2 Corinthians chapter 9 and in verse 13. Those who were relieved, verse 12. For the administration of the service not only supplieth the need of the saints, but also abounds through many thanksgiving to God. Whoever was relieved was offering thanksgiving. Was that descriptive of saints or non-saints? Well, let's go further. Look at verse 13. Whoever was relieved were those who glorify God, while through the proof of the ministry, they glorify God for your obedience of your confession of the gospel of Christ, for your liberal sharing unto them and unto all men. Whoever it was that was relieved was glorifying God. Here's something else. Notice in verse 14, and that by their prayer for you, who long for you because of the exceeding grace of God in you. Those who were relieved received it with prayer. They offered thanksgiving and they glorify God. And furthermore, notice verse 14, they long for you. Were non-saints longing for Paul? Were non-saints longing for Paul? Whoever it was that was relieved was longing for Paul. They were offering thanksgiving. They glorify God. They received it with prayer. Notice back in chapter 8 now, 2 Corinthians 9, 8 and in verse 4, this was called fellowship. Look at chapter 8 and in verse 4. Same event, same contribution, imploring us that with much urgency we'd receive the gift and the fellowship of the ministering of the saints. Here's fellowship, chapter 8, verse 4. 9 and verse 13. Same word is used with reference to sharing or your liberal distribution unto them and unto all men. Now the question is all men limited at all? Is it limited at all? Well, this word, plantos, that is translated all in our text, 2 Corinthians 9:13, can be used in a universal sense. Chad gave us three of these passages, Acts 5:11, 1 Thessalonians 3:12, and 1 Thessalonians 5:15. And he's right about that. It is used in a universal sense that included all. But it's sometimes used in a limited sense, and we'll see that in a moment in 1 Timothy 5 and in verse 20. The question is, what about 2 Corinthians 9:13? My point is, it's limited by context. How do I know that it is universal? It's because of the context. How do I know these are limited? Because of the context. The question is, how is 2 Corinthians 9:13 used? It is not used in a universal sense because it's used that way here, or in a limited sense because it's used there, but it's determined by the context, and that's what we've just shown. The context tells us that. But let's go even further. Here's some parallels that we might draw. Now, he cited to a couple, and we may give attention to those maybe in our question and answer period. But here, I want you to notice 1 Timothy 5 and in verse 20. Here's this in a sense in which it's limited. Those who are sinning rebuke in the presence of all that the rest may fear. And here, those who are sinning would refer to saints. In this case, it's elders. The all, that doesn't imply or demand that it's non-saints, does it? It's used in a limited sense, as per the context. So the same thing may be true with reference to 2 Corinthians 9 and verse 13. There's the saints at Jerusalem. The all men does not demand, the word all does not demand that that mean non-saints any more than it would mean that in 1 Timothy 5 and in verse 20. Well, the Curry pointed out in his commentary on 2 Corinthians chapter 9 from Matthew 5, 3 and in verse 5, an interesting grammatical parallel to this part and whole concept in 2 Corinthians 9:13 may be found in Matthew 3 and in verse 5, which speaks of Jerusalem and all Judea. The city of Jerusalem is located within the province of Judea. Possibly Paul might be using chi in the ascensive sense, which would yield the following translation unto them, even unto all of them, showing the possibility that there is the all as a parallel in Matthew chapter 3 and in verse 5. But I want to show you a few things here with reference to the question of, then to whom does that refer? Who does the all men refer? If it doesn't refer to non-saints, who does it refer to? Well, I want to give you a few quotations here. And the quotations, please understand, that when I quote from some of the scholars that are quoted here, this is not given, and I mentioned in the book, that this is not given as proof. Because whatever Linsky may say, Lipscomb may say, or anybody else may say, does not provide proof. What it does show is there is a possibility that this is the interpretation of that text. And as so has been the appeal this week, let's be honest and let's look at the text, and could this be what this text means? And here are some that suggest that the them refers to the saints at Jerusalem and the all would have reference to other saints. Here's what Linsky said. That secondly, the saints are seen as glorifying God also for the single-mindedness of your fellowship with them and with all, that is, all other saints. You'll say, well, Linsky doesn't prove anything. Well, it just shows that here is another possible interpretation of that passage, what it shows. Barrett says much the same thing, and where he just simply says, Paul uses the word koinonia, and speaking of the collection in 8:4 in Romans 15, 26, with them and with all, that is, with all other Christians. But I find this one interesting, and that is David Lipscomb. David Lipscomb said, seeing their obedience and fidelity to the gospel and their liberality to the poor saints in Jerusalem in the offering they made, prompted them to glorify God for their professed subjection to the gospel of Christ and their beneficence to all men, for their liberality showed that they excluded no Christian from their fellowship. Well, we could go on with others of those. Brother Curry made this observation. The interpolation, all men, King James, New King James, unreasonably implies, contrary to the context, that Paul at the end of this discussion of the collection of the poor saints in Jerusalem suddenly includes unbelievers in the scope of benevolence. And then Olmosson says much the same thing, and I'll let you read the rest of those quotations. There are two others in Thank You. It's what I need. I want to quickly make this observation, and then I want to move to some other matters, and that is that all of us believe in limited benevolence. And that is, all of us here agree that the church cannot relieve a lazy man, 2 Thessalonians 3:10, or the individual's widow. At least I think we do. Maybe we don't. Where Paul said, let not the church be charged. Now, that doesn't mean that anyone is heartless because we believe in limiting our benevolence. That doesn't mean that we don't believe in helping the needy. And that doesn't mean that we don't, that the church can't relieve some. And the emotional pleas that sometimes are made will apply here just as well. Now let's go to chart 78 back there, if you will. I want to turn my attention now to some things that Chad mentioned in his manuscript and in his lecture, if it's all right. Jim said this is not a debate format, but we would be just discussing. Well, we're just discussing. That's what we're doing. And so I want to discuss the premise that Chad laid down toward the end of his lecture. And this is on page 138 and 139 of the lecture, if you want to care to take note of this, that his premise is, how do I know that James 1, Galatians 6, passages that we say are applying to the individual, how do I know they apply to the church? Look at page 138. He said, to show a command can have an application to both the Christian individual and the church collectively, considering the following statement. And he cites 1 Corinthians 11. Over on page 139, obviously Paul's instructions to the Corinthians can have both an individual and congregational meaning. Individuals must partake of the elements. Verse 28 we have right here. And verse 33, they do not do so apart from the assembly. It is entirely possible for a statement in Scripture to have application both to the individual and the congregation. All right, that's the premise. Since that's true, we have the premise of 1 Corinthians 11 showing the Lord's Supper applies to the individual and the church. Therefore, when I come to James 1:27, Galatians 6:10, I can apply it not only to the individual, but I can apply it to the church. That's the premise. Here's the premise on which I learned how to apply those principles. Now read page 138 and 139, see if that's not the premise that's been laid down. Well, let's talk about that premise. Well, in this premise, what we have here is we have the command to observe the Lord's Supper. That applies to the individual in the church, Chad says. Well, there are some commands by their nature involve individual responsibility yet done in conjunction with others. The Lord's Supper would be one. Singing. I sing as an individual, but we're singing as a group by the nature of speaking to ourselves in psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. Our giving, our praying. 1 Corinthians chapter 14, one leads and others follows. I'm praying to God as an individual, but at the same time, another is leading me. And the same thing with drawing. That's something we do in the assembly, 1 Corinthians chapter 5, but I'm not to keep company with him, and that socializing is done outside the assembly as an individual. And so some commands by their nature involve individual responsibility, yet done in conjunction with others. There is nothing, absolutely nothing in the context of in Galatians 6 or James 1 that shows these are to be done in the assembly or in conjunction with others. That I have to do it as a group, like the Lord's Supper. That's quite a leap to go from 1 Corinthians 11 and take that premise and jump over to James 1. Let's go talk about 1 Corinthians chapter 11. 1 Corinthians 11, verse 28 says, let a man examine himself, and so let him eat. While done in the assembly, that is true. The eating and the examining is an individual action, or is that done as a collectivity? How do y'all do it where you worship? I examine myself. We're not examining one another collectively. I don't think that any of you practice that collectively, the examining of yourselves, do you? I don't believe any of you do. And so, yes, here is individual action that may be done in the group, but this eating and the examining is individual activity. But let's go further. Let's take this premise and try it on with other passages. Here's the premise. Remember the premise. Because of 1 Corinthians chapter 11, remember what we just read. Therefore, I can know a command that applies to an individual applies to the church can apply both to the individual and the church. Well, then what about the individual's responsibility in 1 Timothy 5:16a? If any man or woman that believes have willows, let them relieve them. I know that can apply not only to the individual but the church. Even though Paul said, let not the church be burdened, I can apply it to the church because of this premise. What about loving your wife? What about the conjugal right responsibility, 1 Corinthians 7? Or we were treated, not by Chad, but Brother Warpular said, not a single thing that an individual can do that a church cannot do together. No, thank you. There's some things I'm going to do by myself. 1 Corinthians 7 is one of them. What about the command to love your wife? Do you do that as a group or individually? What about the name Christian? Can we take this premise and apply, since this applies to the individual, it'll apply to the church? How does that premise work when it comes to other passages? And on we go with other passages that we could talk about. How much time do I have? I want you to turn with me to page 142, if I might quickly notice this. I want to make this point as quickly as I can. 142 of the book. Chad, Jim told me not to debate you. I'm not debating. We're just studying. I want you to look on page 142. That if James 1:27 is only individual action, then the following things are true. These are the three bullet points, page 142. That would mean each person must provide for the fatherless and the widows. That would mean those unable to do so are unable to exhibit such a religion before God. These two are in the first bullet point. Second bullet point in the book says, then the terms are plural, that is, fatherless and widows. Thus, each individual must provide for a plurality of orphans and widows. My question is, what's the conclusion and what's the point? What's the conclusion and what's the point? Well, it applies to the church is the point. You can't apply this just to the individual, it applies to the church. Well, let's apply it to the church. If James 1:27 applies to church action, that means each church must provide for fatherless and widows. Each church must. And those unable to do so, some of those small churches that can't provide for orphans and widows, can't practice such religion before God, and since the terms are plural, then each church must provide for a plurality of orphans and widows. So if that means it doesn't apply to the individual here, but to the church, then over here it means it doesn't apply to the church. Maybe we need to shift it to an organization now. Let's try that on for size with 1 Timothy 5 and verse 16a. Here's our premise. If it's only individual action, then we can't, that's not going to work because of these principles. What about any man or woman that believeth have widows? Does that mean then that each person must provide for widows? Does that mean then the term widows being plural, that each person cannot just provide for their widow, but for their widows? And if you're not, then you're not practicing 1 Timothy 5:16. How does that premise work? My question is, what's the point? Pay close attention to this, and I'm going to quit on this. It sounds like, and I want Chad to tell us, that what he's saying, what was that page I gave you, 142? Sounds like what he's saying on page 142 of our manuscript, or of the book, that James 1:27 cannot be fulfilled unless it applies to the church. Read those points right there in the bullet point. See if that's not what he's saying. And I'm not charging him with that, but it sounds like he's saying that James 1:27 cannot be fulfilled unless it applies to the church. Because if it's only individual action, then we must each care for widows and orphans. And if not, then we're not exhibiting the religion before God. And since it's plural, we've got to have a plurality of widows and orphans. Each one of us has to have two widows and two orphans. So that must mean then it doesn't apply to the church. That must be what he's saying. That's quite a stretch. And then you couple it with this statement made over on page 143. James tells us what is to be done, and Paul tells us who's to do it. James is telling us what. He's not telling us who. He's telling us what to do. And Paul tells us who's to do it, and it's the church. So James 1:27 cannot be practiced by the individual. It has to be with the church. Seems like that's what's being said. I'll apologize if I'm wrong about that. But once we get it to the church, I don't know about Chad, but some of you are going to shift it off to an organization. You're talking about squeezing things out of James 1. You take the individual, squeeze him out, put the church there. When we get the church there, we squeeze it out and put the organization there. And then you wonder what the difference is between us. Then you wonder what the difference is between us. I'm going to stop on that note. Thank you.